Craig Sogi, and I'm a Deputy Vice Chancellor. Hello. So welcome to all of you to this lecture by Professor Hussein Jerry Kavadia, better known as Jerry Kavadia. Before I introduce Professor Kavadia, let me first say that it's really great that the summer school has come back into the Kramer building. Of course, it's been here before. Those of you who are long-time attendees of summer school know that during the late 1990s, this is where it took place. So it's great to be back here. And this is the 62nd year that the summer school is running. It's a South African institution. Professor Kavadia is going to talk about the new proposals for national health insurance system. And I'm sure there's a great deal of interest. And that's why all of you here, I'm interested in hearing what's to come out of all of this. And he's eminently, of course, qualified to be giving this talk. He's one of two members of the National Planning Commission who have a health background. And he's brought that health background into his the report, the initial reports of the National Health, the National Planning Commission, and the future deliberations of the of that commission. He's currently the director of the HIV Management Cluster, Maternal, Adolescent and Child Health at the University of the Witwatersrand, and he's also the Emeritus Professor of Pediatrics. He had two posts there, in Child Health, and also the Emeritus Victor Dykes Professor of HIV-AIDS Research at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. His work is based in KwaZulu-Natal, in Durban, even though his appointment is at the University of the Witwatersrand. And what he's doing there is documenting new research on maternal, newborn and child health, on which he has built his reputation over the last very many years. He was primarily involved in all aspects of academic paediatrics and built a very productive group during his tenure at UKZN. He was chairperson of the Mandela government's first commission on maternal and child health to design appropriate policies for a new country, and was on a three-person commission to investigate the chronic problems at the University of Durban-Westville. He has also major interest in pursuing justice, democracy, development and freedom during and after apartheid, and he has headed the largest international AIDS conferences to be brought to South Africa. He's done much research on the prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV and was one of a handful of individuals in the country who publicly and consistently opposed the Mbeki administration on their bizarre AIDS policies. Finally, he's also published more than 320 papers on maternal and child health in mostly international journals. Thank you very much, Professor Kavadia.
Thanks very much. Thanks to all of you for being here. It's a bit unusual for me to speak to an audience like you. I've spoken mostly through the Planning Commission. I've spoken through government departments and academics and so on. So it's a real pleasure to speak to you and hear your points of view. I'm going to stop exactly at about 45 or 44 minutes or so, because I want to hear your views. I must tell you, first of all, I'm going to give you lots of information, but please relax. Don't try and remember the details. It's not important. I want to convey one or two messages. And I must tell you even before that there are many critics of what I'm going to tell you. And so, you know, in the words of the politicians these days, what you're going to see and hear is not not an unqualified report or audit. It's really a very qualified one. And there are some very vociferous critics around of what I'm going to say. I'm not going to bother you with the details. It gets rather boring, and it's mostly the minutiae of economic arguments. I'm going to give you the main points, and I will indicate where some people might differ. I'm going to do about two or three or four things. First of all, I want to set the scene about the role of health and the section we wrote in the National Planning Commission's context. So, because I think the context for health is critical. So I'm going to do that, and I'm going to then look at some of the National Planning Commission's recommendations about what are the key problems in the country and what are some of the key issues. And lastly, I'm going to deal with the National Health Insurance Plan. And I'm going to deal with the reasons why it's necessary, what I think are the problems, and some of the solutions that the government has found. But let me tell you up front. The first thing is there's going to be no national health insurance, from my point of view, will have any of our support unless the current really dreadful health system is sorted out. I've lived through apartheid, and I've lived through the Mbeki period, and I'm living here now, and the situation is abysmal. It's absolutely appalling. I have been through many parts of the world, and I presume most of you are from the Western Cape. The Western Cape is almost unique. You have a health service which is not replicated anywhere in the third world. So you must extract yourself from your personal point of view. You've got to put yourself in that political jungle in, where is it, Mpumalanga and Limpopo and all those places, and imagine what healthcare might be like that. And so I'm absolutely certain that we cannot do anything positive about an insurance scheme unless we deal with the current problems. There's a whole multitude of problems. We can discuss that later, but it goes from where I come from. Nurses deciding not to work after 2 o'clock, doctors not pitching up, clinics being insufficiently stocked, and so on and so on. There's an absolute horrendous volume of problems that needs to be solved. Unless we solve that, and it's got nothing to do with the National Health Insurance in some ways, unless we solve that, we won't even solve the first steps to the problem we face. That's what I want to tell you. The second thing is, if you think that private health care in this country is good, you need to think again. It is extraordinarily wasteful of resources. Do I know about it? I spent 6 months in hospital, and I'm not poor. And the bill was 850,000 rand. No doctor or surgeon or anesthetist charged me. It was the hospital. I had the medical aid paid 350,000, and I had to borrow from the medical aid and pay over 2 years. That's how bad the private sector is. I had an abscess on my thigh. They charged me 800 rands, something I could have done over here with a good doctor or a nurse and some local anesthetic. So don't believe for a second these myths that we've got this fantastic and expensive health system. It's not true. We can reduce the costs quite considerably. So my arguments are both. The public sector is in a mess, and the private sector is not cost-efficient, and we are paying more money than we should. Okay? So that's the burden, what I'm going to say. And now I'm going to show you the data on which I make some of the points I do. And I'll go through it quickly, and you know, you're welcome to these slides at any time. If you want to come back, they'll be on the website. So don't worry about the detail. The first couple of points I want to make is that there are very good reasons for thinking about a national health insurance scheme. And the first reason is that it's nothing new. Just look at that slide. Just look at that slide. The only point about that slide is this has been with us for years, decades. And you know where the best example came from? It came from this one here, which was not the ANC. It's not us. It was none of you. It was a sort of hangover of the government during the war. And it was an excellent proposal, but it fell by in the dust because by 1948, the Nats had come in. They didn't like the scheme because it was community orientated. It was for all the people equally, so it fell by the way. So this is not new. And there's a whole list of other attempts at a national health insurance scheme, or what is better understood as a universal coverage. Everyone is equal, and everyone in this country must have equal care, equal access to care. The second slide is simply to point out that it's our constitutional right to have a healthcare system and have access to healthcare. It doesn't say anything about a national health insurance, but it certainly says that you must have access, you must have availability, and you must have roughly equal health care. And at the moment, the private sector only covers about 16.2%, and I'm going to cover all what's written under there. But the point of this is it's a constitutional right, so it's not a matter of free choice what we do unless you understand. The third point I want to make, I want to quote the best authorities I know in the world. So the World Health Organization, as you might know, is really probably one of the organizations, international organizations, which is without doubt relied upon people in developing countries and the developing. There are always endless arguments about the World Bank and IMF. There's no argument about the WHO, World Health. And basically, recently I said, there are three problems you have to solve which cause difficulties with health systems. Health systems means all the personnel, doctors, nurses, the clinics, the services, the drugs, etc. The whole system. If it is too concentrated on hospitals and not on primary health care clinics. Primary health care clinics are the clinics you first go to. You could go to a clinic here, or I could go to a clinic in a rural area. That's the primary health care clinic. So if you don't have that, and you have a hospital-centric system, it's a bad system. Doesn't mean you mustn't have hospitals. It means you must have a fair balance with more of the money going to prevention, for primary health care. Those of you who are mothers, have had kids, know that without immunization and growth and nutrition advice, the care for children will never happen properly. That's what I mean by primary health. The second thing is the fragmentation of services is very destructive. It could be on racial grounds, it could be, but in our case, it's between the rich and the poor. It's private medicine and public medicine. And lastly, this is an extension of that argument, that if there's uncontrolled commercialism, it is dreadful for health. It's dreadful for the health system. So there are many examples in the world. If you take, I know many people think that the United States is the last word. It's not the last word. It doesn't have a very good health system. In fact, it has a really bad health system. It spends more money than anybody else in the world. And how do we measure whether that money spent is any good? We have indicators. You can't say that I waited too long in the queue in Cuba, so that mental health system, that is uncomfortable, but that's not how you measure it. You measure it by the number of women who die around childbirth. You measure it by the number of children who die under five. You measure it by the amount of TB that's there. You measure it about the prevention of it. Then I can go on and on. So those are the indicators which, if you look throughout the world, is not in the United States. You know which is one of the worst countries in the world for public health? It's India. India has an appalling public health system. I'm absolutely shocked that ostensibly a democratic country can have such a dreadful system. Most of the Indians go to private health care. And private health care there means an individual doctor, usually, starting a little clinic, doing deliveries. It's the most ineffective, inefficient, an improbable system in the world. So here's two examples. One spends a lot of money in the US, the results are not very good. The other neither spends money nor has a good public health system. Even the private care is not particularly good. You can take other countries much poorer, and they work wonders. You can take Costa Rica, you can take Sri Lanka. You can take, there's a state in, I don't know how much you know about India, there's a state called Kerala. It's governed by a weird combination, Catholics, Communists, Hindus. And for years, it's recognized that through the liberation of women, it has worked wonders in the social system. So it works there and it doesn't cost much money. And then Cuba is a solid example. When Mandela came into power, he sent some of us there. And I went to look at assess the pediatricians. They've got a fantastic system. You may argue about the business of lack of freedom. I'd rather have healthcare and life and survival than the sort of problems that the Cubans have. So you've got a lot of poor countries, which have wonderful health systems, and their health indicators are better than some of the richer countries. One of the best of the rich countries is, say, Canada and a lot of the Scandinavian. They're much more expensive, but the systems are much more expensive than Scandinavia. So those are the main points I want to make about introduction. And this is a really wonderful little slide to show you that the government isn't all bad. So this is from the National Planning Commission. And it shows that they can actually draw very well. So, I bet you, I don't know how many people are from UCT. They wouldn't equal that often. So, this is the summary of our deliberations. We think the biggest problems are poverty and inequality. Number one, number two, poverty and inequality. And as you know, the two go hand in hand. And some of the issues we need to solve is things like education and employment. So that was the summary of what we think the main problems are. But in detail, this you're familiar with. I mean, the two fields, jobs, the infrastructure, whether it's road, rail, harbor, etc., is crumbling. It is a resource intensive. We rely too much on minerals. We don't have much manufacturing. We don't have other forms of raising jobs or money. And then the spatial divide of our country based on apartheid separates the places in our country where jobs are from the places where people live. Now, Cape Town is a lovely map. It shows you where all the jobs are in the center here. But the people are living way out, and the transport is usually very bad. So that's what I mean. And we understand. I understand perfectly well. To change that is going to take decades and decades. You can't easily uproot people, but we understand. Poor education, if we don't know that now, we don't know anything about what's a real problem. You know, this is a total, complete, and utter disaster. We should be ashamed of ourselves. We are worse than many third world countries. High disease burdens, I'll come to that in a minute. Poor public services, what we're talking about. Corruption, I don't need to remind you. Divided communities, and so on. So, the next slide shows you that I'm going to go this way. The answers are self-evident. So we need to create more jobs, and I'll tell you about that. Crumbling infrastructure, we need to expand infrastructure. We need to diversify and use our resources sustainably. We need to transform our spaces, get people nearer their jobs or jobs nearer where they live. We need to that's self-evident. Provide quality health care. And build a capable state. By a capable state is, what we mean is, all the horrors, these so-called cadres of incompetent and often ignorant people running our services, whether it is SAA or the clerk at SAA, I mean the CEO, not the current, previous CEO, the CEO of SAA or many of these state-operated entities, whether it was Transnet in the past, any of them. I mean, the whole lot need to be improved or replaced. The next one is corruption. You know, not easy to win. From what I understand, almost everywhere in the world, corruption is a major, major problem. India has it to an extent you can't believe. There's a man who's gone on a mission like Gandhi, who's fasting and trying deadly hard, but they're still trying to prevent him. This parliament is trying to prevent him. And uniting the nation, which is really easier said than done. But in the Planning Commission, we spend a lot of time, and it interested me a lot, to say, how do we overcome the fact that you will find it hard to hear what I say without recognizing that my forefathers were Indian? That's it. And I can't forget that you are white mostly, or you are African, or you are colored. We see each other through those sorts of masks, and we need to overcome that. Once again, it's easier said than done. How do you build national identity? And what does it mean to have an identity? And I had a lot of problems for many years, and people kept raising the question of my being Indian or South African and so on. And we discussed that between all of us. And it's self-evident to me now that none of us, you nor me, have one identity. I'm a loyal South African boy, but also I have my forefathers in India. I also remember that, and also have remnants of that culture in my everyday life with my family and my food and whatever else. So All of us are made up of multiple cultures, and they came to those sorts of conclusions. Anyway, those are the problems and the solutions, and here's what we need. Once again, easier said than done, prosperity and equity. But I want to emphasize equity. You cannot live in a country which is as unfair and inequitable as South Africa. The rich are there and the poor are there. And like that is so all over the world, but not to the extent as in South Africa. Can we measure the answers? Yes, there's a coefficient, and that coefficient says we are probably the worst in the world. If we are not, then we are very near the top. Okay, so those are some of the solutions. This is what we need. I'm going to go through it quickly. So we need strong leadership, effective government, and an active citizenry, which means you and me. And these are the things we should do: improve our capabilities, opportunities, and conditions, and raise living standards, poverty. You're familiar with this. I'm not going to repeat all of that. And social cohesion is what I've been speaking about. And that's it. So I'm going to just quickly go through some of the problems we face, which we looked at. And that's education. And here's Tandi. And here's grade one. And here is, what's that? University admission. Okay? Grade one. You know, this is Tandi. Enrollment very high, more than 1.2 million. But look at this. Look at this. I mean, it's just utterly, utterly dreadful. Hardly a fraction of the people who actually should be educated are being educated. And that's not enough. It's bad enough. But when I look at the quality of education, the quality just astounds me. I hear endless stories about kids with 9 A's and 10 A's and 30 A's. And I don't want to go back to the old days because nostalgia is no good. And I don't think the old days were particularly good. But you know, in those days to get an A was an unusual event. So there's something wrong with the quality. And I think everyone knows you get people who pass matric can't write 2 sentences properly or speak coherently for 2 seconds. So coming back to the national health system that we looked at within the planning commission. So I'm not going to say anything more about the planning commission. I want to tell you about health. This is our view of what the solution should be for this dreadful system. At the top, funnily enough, is what? It's water, it's sanitation, it's housing, it's employment, and all the things I referred to earlier, which keep people poor, oppressed, gender imbalances, and so on. Those are the social determinants. That is number one. Then strengthening the health system. All that, I told you there are many, many faults. We've got to strengthen the public health system, and part of it is universal coverage. I'm not quite sure why they introduced the term health insurance. When you speak of national health insurance, it raises the hackles of many people who get frightened out of their lives that suddenly they're going to nationalize everything, and we'll all be waiting in long queues, and there'll be a cadre of doctors who don't give a hoot, and nurses who don't care. That's the image it conjures up, but that's not what it means. It really means providing equal and universal coverage. And lastly, optimizing management and prevention of the major causes of disease and death. And I'm going to cover that very quickly. So that's our main recommendations. Social determinants, all the things you know about, housing, etc. The health system, including that, and looking after some diseases. Now what we want, I'm not an economist, but what we want, if this is economic growth, and that is social equity, that means fairness, going up straight that way is not an answer. Being rich, but being unfair and unjust is not an answer. And on the other hand, being poor without having resources is not an answer. So what we need to aim is something in between, where we are both just and grow. All right, it may be difficult, it's not impossible. It's not, but all I wanted to do is get rid of the idea that all we need is a rapid GDP. I mean, India has got a GDP of 7%, China has 8%. Many of them haven't solved their problems. So the point is to do both at the same time. And I think it's possible. So this is another one of those wonderful slides. Just worry about one of them. So what should we be doing? We should be looking at our economic dilemma, and we don't want this, but we want that. So what we need to do for good jobs, We need labor-intensive manufacturing, service, and export. So you would think that that's self-evident, but that's a major one of those economic recommendations. So now I go to the things I'm most familiar with. And that is, this is, so we wrote, we are meeting about 20 of us. I don't know if you're familiar with a British journal called The Lancet. The Lancet is the premier clinical journal in the world. So The Lancet asked some of us to write about the South African health service, okay? And we did that, about 25 of us each, a little chapter we wrote. And so this is from that. And a lot of the evidence I give you is really, really strong. It's based on that series of papers which have been published, they've been reviewed, they've been peer-reviewed, they've been internationally reviewed, and they exist now in a form where if you quote that, it's one of the most reliable, so it's even more reliable than what the government can say. Okay? And it's got a lot of paper from all of that. So there are four big problems in our country. We have four colliding epidemics. You're familiar with that, I'm sure someone wrote through. We have a huge epidemic of AIDS and TB, okay? We have a huge epidemic of mothers dying and children dying before they should. We have a massive epidemic of violence and injury, and you know about that. And the type of violence is a peculiar one. We have the worst form of interpersonal violence. So I'm not talking about car accidents and criminality. The worst form of interpersonal, what do you mean by interpersonal? It often, most often means man and woman, and man against man, and if woman. And lastly, we have a growing burden of something that affects me and people that we live like we do. That's non-communicable diseases. The commonest one is diabetes. The second one is cancer. And the third one is lung disease. That's the growing epidemic. We thought that it would only be affecting people who are prosperous. And that was believed until now. But it's now been shown clearly, that in African populations throughout the continent, it's the rising problem. And it's expensive, it's hard to treat, and it's the major cause of mortality in the world. Major cause of mortality. People are not, in the world, globally, they're not dying from that, they're dying from this. Cardiovascular disease. Don't you hear about strokes every day? And heart attacks every day. That's it. So, here's what's happening in South Africa about under 5 mortality. And that's the trend from the year where it was 55 to more or less now, 2008. And you'll see, for various reasons, we were succeeding in bringing down. I told you this is a really important indicator. And somewhere here, with this one here is 1990. So, I'm sorry for my friends in the ANC. But it all happened before them. And then when they came, Lord forbid, it went up. I'm not saying it's just coincidental. They're not entirely to blame for everything. But they're not to blame for that. A lot of things happen. They walk into independence. They walk into independence. They walk into an AIDS epidemic. They walk into dislocation and so on. Unsurprising that. I think it's going to come down quickly. Because Dr. Motsoaledi is different kettle of fish. And it's that under 5 mortality is not a neutral indicator of health. You can see here, the higher this is, the higher, sorry, this is under infant mortality. That's mortality in the first day. It's very high if you are poor. This is South African data. It's very low if you live very well. So where I live, let's say, I don't know, probably here. So our infant mortality in my community would be there. But in the really poor areas, and you can guess, I guess in Khayelitsha or something, Cape is a bad example. If you take Mpumalanga or KwaZulu-Natal. So it's not neutral. Now, here's what I think the government is capable of doing. Okay, the reason I put it up is to show you that can it succeed? Is the government capable of working? And the answer is yes. Yes, yes, yes. The problem we've had is from 1994, think about it, we've wasted 15 years doing nothing except damage. We nearly ruined science. You remember the day when they said HIV don't cause? Do you remember they said that these drugs are poisonous? Because 300,000 lives could have been prevented for those stupidities. We have lost thousands, I don't know how many children were born HIV, and so on and so on. But the point is, so can the government, which is mainly there, can it do good? And the answer is yes, because we've got a new dispensation, we've got a new Minister of Health who knows exactly what he's doing. We support him, the world supports him. And some of the things that have happened is, we have the largest antiretroviral program in the world, and in many cases, it's very efficient. It works well, it mobilizes communities, we spend a lot of money. We've tested 2 million to 12 million people for HIV. So if you don't know you've got HIV, how do you go for treatment? And if you know you've got HIV, you go for treatment. And I don't want to waste your time now, but there is some phenomenal research came up in the past few months that if you go on antiretroviral, you don't transmit it to your partner who's uninfected. Is that okay? So if you go on antiretrovirals, you're HIV positive, and you're using them well, it's a preventive measure also. That means you don't transmit the virus to your partner, because the viral load, which is the amount of virus in your blood, goes down, down, down. And even though you have risky sex, it may not pass it. Is that okay? So, it's done a lot of that. Then we've got lots of persons, almost a million people, 1.4, on ARVs. We've got increase in resources, students, infrastructure, etc. And it's going on all this. So there's a lot. What's the best evidence? I'm a pediatrician. I told you I work on mother-child transmission. And in the late 1990s, Glenda Gray and Joe and our group in Durban tried to find out of every 100 HIV positive women, how many transmitted the virus to the baby, and it turned out to be about 32. Okay? 32 HIV positive mothers who transmit the virus to the baby. Good treatment, etc. What is it now? It's a phenomenal 3.5%. That's absolutely amazing. What's it in New York and Britain? It's about 2.8. KwaZulu-Natal is not far. So is that success or not? It is. In fact, it's a lesson of, it's a massive success. Massive success. And it's done through provisional. Are there any other things? This is what Dr. Matsu said. He's going to, so if you people drink a lot, you'll have a problem. If you smoke, well, you should be smoking. But if you do, it's going to cause it. And then fast food, which is the other epidemic, All the fast food epidemic. Well, you know what I'm talking about, these habits we import from the West, mostly, the fast food. That's the next disaster. It's obesity, hypertension, cardiovascular disease, strokes, etc. And then he wants to tackle the curative system and look at how we can reduce the cost, etc. I just want to put this up. Please don't read it. I also want to tell you that UNL will have to face climate change. And you might know there was COP17 in India. And at the end of it, there was a declaration on the health consequences of climate change. So we need to tackle that in the future, and we haven't even begun to think about it. So now, lastly, to the National Health Insurance. What does it do? It pools risk. It says to people, and this is not new, I lived in Britain for a couple of years, and absolutely admired what they did, except when Blair came and sort of diluted. But after the Second World War, they had a great system, lasted for a long time. It's called the National Health System. What you do is you say, we know they are rich and poor, but what you're going to do is we're going to mix, pool our resources. The rich must contribute to the poor, and when the poor get wages, etc., they must contribute to the poor. So that's pooling up, and that's essential. That's what we need to do. We have to accept that. And is it going to cost us? Well, let's see what it costs us. But remember that we could probably improve the private sector so that the cost can be borne by. Improve access and quality, strengthen the public sector, and procure services on behalf of the entire population and not only a minority. So that's the NHI. So I must tell you now how unequal the two systems are. Although people contest this, this is from the Lancet paper, it's from, I don't know if she's here, Diane McIntyre, you know? She's an economist in the UCT. So she did this graph from that paper I'm talking about. So here's the investment from 1996 to over 10 years. That's in the public sector. That's expenditure per head in the public for health. Public sector, private sector. What do you expect then? You know, what do you expect if this caters for a larger population? And I'm not saying, remember what I said at the beginning, they are not using that money well. And just remember, I'm not making excuses. Whatever money they had, they could have used it better than they have done. But there's no comparison between what's going to the private sector and what's been happening to the public sector. And so, what are the other inequities? Here is the percentage of our wealth going for health. 4.1% in the private, the same in the public, okay? But look at the size of the population covered. 16% in the private sector, 84% in the public sector. So there are two things I might criticize that, but it's a matter of teaching rather than substance. So they might argue about that, but I'm not really interested now in answering that. But you can see the huge, that's the biggest disparity. The amount of money going to the public sector is much, much smaller. And here's a very nice slide which shows you the percentage of share of need and benefits. It takes people who are in the poorest quartile, that's here, poorest people, richest people. Richest people have, these are benefits, they have maximum benefits, the poorest have the least health benefits. We need to somehow reverse that. Here's the number of personnel in the public sector and private sector. All I wanted to, don't worry about the details, but we have more hospitals in the public sector. That doesn't mean it's good. You know what most of them are like. And we have more beds, and that's the same story. But what we have is fewer personnel, almost the same number of personnel, health personnel, to look after two disparate groups of people. And here's the percentage of GDP. I've already shown you 5% in the private sector and 3.5% in the public sector. I'm still talking about inequity. So those personnel may be not, don't look too different. But the important thing is, look, these areas here, the medic, where are the doctors? Well, they're not in the country, first of all. I understand the figure is huge. I don't know if it's 60%, maybe it's something, but you know the point is, I've met South African nurses and doctors in Dublin, London, wherever you go. They've gone to the Middle East, they've gone to the West, they've gone everywhere except where they should. But the percent in the private sector of medical is about 70-69. Remember, once again, they're looking after a minority of the population. And all these people here, you couldn't get a dentist in the public sector if you cried, because most of them are in the private sector, 85%. They don't have dentists virtually. Maybe they are no post, but that's the government's fault. All I'm saying, these are the facts. I don't know what these people are, environmental health practitioners. Heaven knows what they do. Environment seems to be going to court, and then these people are up. How many about 11,000 of them? Pharmacists, 84% in the private. Psychologists, 93%. Physiotherapists, what's it, 80%, so on. The point I'm making is some very important and skilled people are sitting in the private sector. They're not sitting in the public sector. When I told you I got sick long ago in the 80s, the best brains were in the public sector. The best beds were in the public sector. And when I got really sick and I was put in a private hospital, I have a wonderful friend from Cape Town called Walter Gurney. He's a great old public. He pulled me out of that private hospital and took me to King Edward. And you got to see King Edward too. It's like, you know, living in the antediluvian past. I mean, it's so rickety and old. And that's where I survived, because the doctors were good and the nurses were good. That's important. You don't want a fancy hospital. I don't want a fancy reception room. And a receptionist in, you know, what's it, Armani clothes or so. I want somebody who smiles at me. And then the first moment I enter, ask you, where's my 2,500 rands deposit for giving your medical aid, or call your wife, or do that. I don't want that. I just want someone to speak to me decently. And I hope we can achieve that. So anyway, all these expensive, skilled people are not there. I'm not going to go through that. I'm not going to go there. I'm just going to tell you that there's a huge effort to improve doctors' nursing. Are we going to succeed? It's going to take us a long, long time. Do I know any country which has succeeded developing? I don't. So the question is, they will never be for a long time. Never is an exaggeration, but you know what I mean. For a long time, maybe in your lifetime, certainly in my lifetime, never going to be enough doctors. Trust me, never going to be enough. So we're going to find alternative solutions. There are alternatives. We need mid-level health workers. We need clinical assistants. We need assistant pharmacists. We need community health workers. We need what traditional birth that work. We take the whole range of them. It's not new. China had done it long ago. And you know, I saw a documentary on Mozambique. So they found these maternal mortality, you know, these around pregnancy. I mean, that's peaceful. I mean, it goes on in Afghanistan every day. But Mozambique said, hey, we can't allow women to die. So they said, let's get our nurses, we'll train them how to do it, not just deliver cesarean section. So those nurses in Mozambique are doing cesarean section under supervision. But you know, if you have desperate conditions, you need desperate measures. And so that's the only way we'll solve it. We're not going to be able to train doctors and have 60% going in overseas and 30% going to private practice and so on. So I have a bone to pick with private hospitals. So that's my prejudice. And that's the Minister of Health prejudice. He told me, I can't remember, he said, somebody higher, the President of Botswana or Minister, he phoned him up and said, hey, what sort of a country are you running? I sent somebody, I might have been for a delivery, ordinary delivery. It's those nurses and community health workers. And for historical reasons, in all of our communities, traditional birth attendants used to look after. It cost 40,000 common delivery. And, okay. That's to get up to 45 minutes. Okay, let me go quickly now. Okay, my private hospital. Bad. Okay, I'll go quickly through this. For these reasons. So what are the problems? Is these guys, my wife is a dermatologist. So I have a conflict of interest, but anyway. So these are the problems. Not the GPs, those poor guys are really not doing too well. These guys are the other problem. Why do you need, how can administrators earn more than general practitioners? General practitioners are the backbone of any health system. You go to Britain, how was it so successful? The GPs, they used to say, hey, no, you don't need to go to a specialist. You go back, you're going to get better in 3 days' time. You don't need an operation and you don't need antibiotics. That's what we need. So here's something, private hospital, you got the picture. Huh? The critic who is very voluble says it's about 70%. Okay, so what? Now I mean 70% uncare. Is it bad or good? Bad. And similarly, the amount of money we spend for medical aid, which is a surrogate marker for private medicine, is 11,150 over 10 years and 2,800. More inequities. And here's the amount of income you contribute towards medical scheme. If you are poor, you contribute about 14%, more than. If you're very rich, you contribute 5.5%. Okay, so this is how the NHI will work. This is what we're going to do, all right? This is what we're going to do. And I'm committed to improve the primary health care. GPs, primary health care, nurses, whatever else. And let's sort out the financing. And let's make the administration cheaper. And let's overhaul the whole system. So those are I'm only going to talk about these two things here. So, here's, this picture just tells you, don't just build a tent. Build a good quality, better nurses, better doctors, and better drugs. That's the meaning of this diagram. So that improves the quality of the health care you provide. This is another complicated diagram, but don't worry about it. All it's saying is the primary health care system in the rural areas and maybe even in the urban areas will be made up of a team. It will have specialist support like the critical people, although the surgeon cannot like it, is a pediatrician like me, is an obstetrician, maybe one or two others, general practitioner, maybe even an anesthetist. And so you have a team, and then you have a district hospital, and then you have all these services at the primary health care level. And there's another diagram which is the same thing that spells out for each clinic, one professional nurse, two and so on, and then community health workers for 250 families. So there's a lot of detail about what the primary health care is. Where's the money going to come from? It's going to come from us, from employers, sorry, individuals, us, and from the taxpayers, which is also us. And I don't want to go through this in any detail, but I asked the Treasury to come and present to the Planning Commission, and they've got lots of figures of what it's going to cost. And the main thing, if you remember what's in green, is that it is going to the cost is going to go up. It's going to go up. $125 billion is now to $255 billion over a 14-year period, or that's model one. Model two is $128 billion and going up even higher. And the biggest cost drivers are antiretrovirals, the National Health Laboratory Service, and equipment. And this is a composite diagram. Basically, it tells you that whatever we do, the stuff here in purple, we have to do, whether you have a National Health Service or not, because that's our health service. See that purple is existing health service. So that's got nothing to do with the NHI in some way. What is the administration of the NHI is this bit here. It goes from here, here, here. It goes to about 10%. The green here is additional services, which might be ARVs or cardiovascular diseases and so on. So part of the NHI is not that expensive. I'm going to skip this. I'm going to skip that. And I'm going to... No, I don't want to quote this. This was an argument my friend from the HSRC, Olive Shisana, I don't know if you know her. She's quite an aggressive woman. And she had a quarrel with one of the critics and told him that you're not a primary healthcare physician. In fact, you're not a physician at all. And your argument is full of holes. And there's this man with a wonderful sounding name, Tony Twine, who also thinks that a growth rate won't be high enough and so on. So this is a KPMG study. So it's not the Communist Party, and it's not the ANC, but it's a KPMG study. That's what I put it up. And basically they say, just consider this last one, 1.1% increase in personal tax or under 1% in VAT is needed between those years, and it will fund the NHI to the cost of $10.4 billion. And the next one makes a point which I made much earlier. Is it going to cost us here? You drink too much, you have alcohol, you have tobacco, what is the other one? If you eat too much, and so on. If you eat the wrong food, you're uncaustic. I don't know what unfortified wine means. I'm a Muslim by birth, so it doesn't mean I don't. Muslims don't drink, but I don't drink. Okay. So the last thing is, you know, the one thing that upsets me in this country is a very low level of intellectual debate, and I don't mean that in taxing. I mean, the utter rot you hear from government, the utter nonsense you hear from some of its proponents makes me want to weep, and if I was younger, more annoyed, it made me want to emigrate. It's so awful that we have to live under such conditions. It's like we have regressed to some medieval period in the way we talk and think and act, and it reminds me of this wonderful philosopher, Habermas. And what he says is, whatever you do, you need political legitimation. You need to have a rational discourse. You don't come and tell me that, you know, you're Indian, so you can't trust me. That's all trite or so. Don't tell me that, you know, you have to pay for the sins of apartheid. Let's solve the problem here and now. There's a money, there's a problem, solve it. Don't talk utter trite. It must be rational discourse. And then he goes on to say that you can't make that decision alone. We can't make this NHI decision between you and me. We have to go to the people. And that's what it's saying. We have to reflect their needs, fears, values. And I wonder how many ordinary people you're here, given the fact, would oppose a national health insurance. Because as I told you, it's in your interest and mine. Because it would be cheaper, it would be better, it would be more affordable. We won't have those sorts of difficulties and polarities between our lifestyle and the lifestyle of the country. There's an enormous psychological and maybe even a religious and even personal profit
benefit in knowing that you're living well and you're living with all your fellow human beings well and treating everyone equally. That's what I meant by that. And lastly, that civil society association. And we are not unique, but we do have many civil society organizations, more than most developing countries. I know from the anti-apartheid days, we used to have, you might have forgotten, but we had a thing called the UDF, ANC pretended to exist. They actually had a UDF. In fact, they opened it here. That was the opening session. And that UDF was made up of women's organizations. It was made up of rent parties. It wasn't made up of fiery communists and socialists or whatever else, or capital. Made up of ordinary people. And in those sorts of civil society also, in which we are rich, which can map, filter, amplify, bundle and transmit the problems, needs, and values of a national system. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Gavardia. We have to be out of here about 2 o'clock, which means that we have just about 10 minutes for questions. So I'll take a round and say 3 or so questions, and if we can please make Professor Gavardia and give you an opportunity to respond. So I see 1, 2, 3, 4, sorry, I'm going to see if we have more time. All right, please go ahead.
Thanks very much for the outline. Is there any sort of release of this link to the finance? Is the finance released the link to the release? What's going to come first, the money or the healthcare?
Okay. Remember, I spent a lot of time.
Can we just get them out?
Oh, okay. What does that mean?
So do you want me to record them for you?
No, I'll forget. I have an issue.
Oh, all right, then.
I'll answer you. So I'll be very brief, but basically I pointed out that we must sort this health system out. Whatever we do 25 years down the line, we've got to solve the problems now. So that comes first. That was that green column. And it's got very little to do with our commitment to the NHI. My frank opinion is, as far as I told you, it's going to take us a long time, 25 to 30 years, before we get anywhere near an insurance scheme for the country.
Please go ahead.
If the NHI is implemented, what will happen to private sectors, private practitioners, and private medical aid? Will the NHI, will the national fund pay just the difference? What will they pay for?
I can't answer it in detail, but what will happen,
the majority of the people will be paying, including you and me, for this national health insurance. So you want to use it, you use it. You want to use it, it's okay.
So
you can get, there'll be other medical aids. Let's say you want private hospital care, you can pay extra. So other medical aid will exist in like Holland and all there, maybe 2, 3, 4 additional medical aid schemes. So that's what people pay. If you ask me what's happening in the world, the country we like most is Brazil. They do try this extensively, but they still a private sector.
There was a question around here. Please go ahead.
With the Planning Commission, there's a general feeling that you're taking an awful long time to come up with some plans, and when you do, it's going to be too late to implement them because a new government is blitz.
New government might be even better, I don't know. But you're right. But you know, you take 20, how many of us are there? 26 or 24. All coming with different ideas, and many of them are technical experts, many of them are businessmen, to now will them into one set of proposals which we're going to get. You know, I didn't bring the full set. I would have had to pay an overcharge for weight because it's so big. So we got it in detail. Please don't read it. Don't read it. But the summary will tell you there's a lot of recommendations. I think my bigger worry is not the change of government. My bigger worry is we're a planning commission. Who is going to implement it? It's going to be the same ministers who have given us hell all these 15 years, didn't raise their voices in objection when they proposed science. So that's the big problem. And I think we don't have a chaos. And I hope now when we work, it will come up. But I think it takes time.
Okay. Now, there was a person whose hand was up in that region that I recognized the sign first. Okay.
at the back there, please, young man.
Sounds like Armageddon, but it's not so bad. I told you my wife is a dermatologist. My daughter works for, what's it? One of these financial companies. Momentum Health. So I'm in it, and I know. And do they have fears? Yeah, but I think they're unwarranted. They're not going to be dragooned into. We're not a Stalinist political reality. I'm not saying we won't be sometimes, and I listen to some of these characters. I'm reminded of Paul Pot and a whole lot of other guys. But short of that, it's not going to happen. You know, I think politically it's not possible, really, you know. We haven't worked that way, and I don't think. And you can tell your family that, please, don't worry about that. They will not, they may not make as much. No, they will make money, don't worry.
If you'd like, you can please engage with Mr. Gavali outside the room. But please, this is the very last.
Your comments, please, as I understand what you said, in essence, really, the medium term, long term, 10, 15 years emphasis is really going to be on trying to get private healthcare costs under control, which is the bugbear, certainly in Europe and the United States, and try to establish a better primary healthcare system in South Africa. Health insurance is million years down the track. So why even talk about it when everybody under the
heart of the problem? Exactly. So didn't I tell you that I don't know why they chose national, they should have said universal coverage. Did any of you object? Nobody would. And you're absolutely right. Sort of the cap, the private care cost, and improve the public health. That's basically it. Will national health insurance come? It may come 35 years down, may come much later, I can't say. I know it's not going to be quick, and it won't be 120 years. You're right.
So please tell me, join me in thanking you.